From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, Liberia has suffered so much from war and conflict over the decades, but Ebola could leave an even greater mark.
It's altering us as a people and the distinctive things we've come to associate with being Liberian.
Also, Iraq War veteran and poet Brian Turner talks to me about his new memoir.
My squad leader said to me one time, we're in the job of hunting for people's souls. And of course, the contract that goes with that is that others will hunt for our own.
And in honor of Banned Books Week, our own Rebecca Hersher examines one children's book that makes some American parents very uncomfortable.
What we see in this book is illustrations of the sex act. And whereas some people chuckle, I think for some people it's alarming.
And Jennifer Hudson makes an album her way. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. The Ebola epidemic in West Africa keeps getting scarier. It has killed more than 2,600 people, and that number is certain to keep growing. The U.S. is sending thousands of troops to help build treatment units. The command center for that operation is in the Liberian capital of Monrovia, which is one of the hardest hit areas. The World Health Organization says the virus is spreading exponentially there due to a lack of treatment facilities. Jude Moore is the deputy chief of staff to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. In an open letter to the international community, he writes that his country is, quote, running out of time. I spoke with Jude Moore yesterday via Skype from Monrovia. I began by asking him if he's seen changes there since President Obama pledged more support.
Yes. Yesterday, there were American planes landing at Roberts Field. So there has been an uptick in the movement ever since President Obama announced.
What exactly are the American planes bringing right now?
Mainly people. Know that yesterday, too, they were supposed to begin bringing components of the field hospital, but I didn't see anything. I didn't see that. What I saw was soldiers, mainly technical people.
And can you describe how the epidemic has changed in the past few weeks? What have you seen there in the capital?
It's worsened, which is what prompted my letter, because what happened was in the last week, there was just this explosion in the number of deaths. And we basically, about a week ago, needed about 1,000 beds, and we had a total of 260. And what frightened us, I guess, is that in another 14 to 21 days, when the symptoms begin to become evident in the family members that are now treating the infected, these cases were going to explode.
Mr. Moore, you said that there's been some more relief coming in the last couple of days. How far away are you from having the number of beds, the number of treatment units that you need to deal with this?
Optimistically, 2 weeks. And to be honest, Arun, I think in 2 weeks, I think we should be clear. Liberia is very happy with the scale of the response, especially from the Americans. That response is adequate to the problem that we're faced with, but that response would have significantly altered the picture had that response come 2 weeks ago. I've been working with the WHO engineer who's supervising the construction of these Ebola treatment units to expand the number of beds we have. But if you need 1,000 beds and have 260, and the symptoms show themselves in 2 weeks to 3 weeks, in 2 weeks, we will probably need significantly more than 1,000 beds.
And finally, Mr. Moore, you were born and raised in Liberia. In the letter we've been talking about, you write, "It is hell here." Can you tell us what you've seen, how you're dealing with it personally?
I know a friend who works for an airline and has a neighbor whose wife died, who's at home with his children, and he's showing all the symptoms. She's been calling me. I've been calling the people at the Ebola treatment units, and there's nobody. There's no way. And all of these people remain in their homes and in their neighborhoods. It's cast a pall over the city and over everything, over all our lives. I was in church on Sunday, and the pastor was preaching, and then he was making an indication as if he was going to touch one of the parishioners, and then he stopped midair and said, "Everybody's looking at me. Of course, I'm not going to touch this man." It has affected every part of our lives. There's a Liberian handshake, and it means nothing now because nobody ever does that. It's affected how we greet each other, how we grieve. It's altering us as a people and the distinctive things we've come to associate with being Liberian. And that's what I meant when I say it's hell out here. And until we can create enough space to be able to isolate the sick, to be able to take them away from their families, I'm afraid that this is going to continue to go on. And it is out of this desperation that I reached out to my friends, everybody I knew when I was in the U.S. I wrote them to say, look, we've written the U.S. president this letter. Call your congressman. Do anything you can to move the U.S. system so that we can be able to get a response that is adequate to the problem we face, because it's hell out here.
Jude Moore is the Deputy Chief of Staff to Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. He joined me via Skype from Monrovia. Jude Moore, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity, and it's been great being with you.
War and poetry may be equally ancient. Some of the earliest known poems celebrate and lament organized killing. America's recent wars have created a new generation of war poets, none more distinguished than Brian Turner. In poems about his experiences in Iraq, like The Hurt Locker, R&R, and What Every Soldier Should Know, he spoke for a lot of young people trying to make sense of what they saw and felt. Turner's latest book is prose, but it certainly reads like poetry. My Life as a Foreign Country is a memoir in which Turner reveals how war, once experienced, becomes a permanent part of who you are.
Mosul is inside me, all of its buildings, all of its smoke and pollution. It's 1.7 million people. The university district and the bridges over the winding river, barber shops and ice trucks and sheep grazing in the ruins of Nineveh, minarets, water buffalo and the eucalyptus groves where the rotting uniforms of Saddam's military continue to disappear, the dead Canadians out by the television station, the Kurdish Peshmerga standing guard behind sandbagged machine gun emplacements stationed around their regional political office, old men staring from the automotive shops, the bird-like bodies of their grandchildren chasing after us through the neighborhoods, the ghosts rising from the mist along the river, the slow-moving ghosts in the streets and alleys of Mosul, the many ghosts returning to their homes each night to sleep with the ones they love.
Brian Turner comes from a long line of warriors. His father served during the Cold War, his uncle fought in Vietnam, his grandfather in the Second World War, his great-grandfather in the First. I asked him why he struggles with answering the simple question, why did you enlist?
For years, people have asked me after poetry readings, for example, why did I join the Army? And I would give them a shorthand, which was that I come from a long military tradition. But I realize that there are layers and levels within that answer that I wasn't really meditating into, or I didn't really have access to. So that was the prompt for writing this book. And then what I found was that it's something I'm still grappling with, and I'm not quite yet able to answer. And the book itself led me into other questions that were unexpected.
Now, I've heard plenty of accounts of growing up in military families, but none like yours, Brian. Your dad built a martial arts studio in the garage, and you guys mixed napalm, as best as I can tell, for fun.
Well, we lived in the Central Valley of California, and it's near cattle rangeland and grape vineyards. And on foggy days in the winter, it was perfect. We would go out there and no one could see us. My dad made an igniter, and we had a proper, distance away from it, we thought. And for a boy, it was kind of perfect. But now looking back on it, it does seem pretty bizarre to think that we were making napalm and blowing things up in the backyard.
One of the things that's so fascinating in this book is the way that your experience of war connects you with your family, your father, your uncle, your grandfather, even your great-grandfather's experiences.
Yeah, I wish the women in my life, my mother, my grandmother, and my family, they're connected to this conversation just as deeply. Mm-hmm. But this particular book, I really try to follow one vein and try to see masculinity and war and the development of myself as a man. But I think there's probably another book in the future that will look to the other side of the house and learn a great deal.
You write with this deep awareness of multiple perspectives on war. I mean, you're writing in this book at times from the point of view of families caught in the crossfire, bomb makers in Iraq, as well as the kamikaze pilots who fought your grandfather. And it just seems strange because I always thought one of the things about war is that if you're fighting, if you're a warrior, you can't think of your enemy as having an identity in that way.
In the very moment when bullets are in the air, that kind of thing, you're right. I mean, it's more primal and much more dependent on fear. And people say training. For me, it was just fear. But outside of those moments, the vast majority of the experience that I had when I was in Iraq, for example, I would often wonder about the people who had shot at us prior, maybe the day before, the people whose houses we were about to raid that night. One of them could take my life, or there's a chance I could take theirs. And I wanted to understand them.
And when you're under mortar fire, you write this phrase, someone is hunting for your soul. Soul is actually a word that pops up in this book a lot.
Yeah, it's something my squad leader said to me one time. You know, men were in the job of hunting for people's souls. And, of course, the contract that goes with that is that others will hunt for our own.
Flipping back and forth in time in this book, it feels like, to me, it's more than just a narrative device. It's a way in which these experiences really stay with you and pervade your life, all, you know, years later.
Part of me hopes that through some of these moments, they might be completed in the reader in a way that the war might come home. And I know that's very difficult. You know, I don't want to sort of inflict pain or indict, the citizens around me. But this is a part of our time, and I want to be in a dialogue with people about it.
Imagine you have a grandson, and, he was thinking about joining the infantry, taking on part of the family tradition. Is there something that you would say to him that you wish that your grandfather had said to you?
There'd be two things. The first and most fundamental would be, do you want to live a life in which you have taken part in taking someone's soul, taking the last breath of their life and placing the dirt over their grave? Can you walk into the rest of the days of your life with that weight? The other thing I would say is encourage them to go to a foreign country and live in a foreign country for a year, to experience the space itself, but also to be able to look back from another part of the globe and see America with a certain remove and see its place in the world. I think they'll be much richer in their lives for that experience, for one. And then the second part of that is that if they still want to join the military, then I know they're fully committed to this idea, and they'll be better soldiers for it.
Brian Turner is best known as a poet, and his new memoir is called My Life is a Foreign Country. Brian, thank you so much.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
It's Banned Books Week, time to assess which books make Americans most uncomfortable. Violence and curse words are two of the top three reasons books get banned in the U.S. The third reason, surprise, is sex, which is how a sex education book for children became one of the most banned books in America. Did you hear that, parents? This story is about a sex education book for kids 10 and older, and it will last about 3.5 minutes. You know what to do. Here's NPR's Rebecca Hersher.
In the world of book banning, sex is a loose term. Last year, the top banned book in America was the kids' story, Captain Underpants. It was banned for potty language and toilet humor. The sex ed book It's Perfectly Normal, which is meant for kids 10 and over, is a little more explicit than that. Barbara Jones is the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association.
What we see in this book is illustrations of the sex act, women and men naked. And you see people with lumps here and lumps there. And whereas some people chuckle, I think for some people it's alarming.
Full color illustrations of lumpy, naked people have helped make It's Perfectly Normal one of the most banned books in America. Since its initial publication in 1994, the book has been challenged or banned every year. Michael Emberly illustrated the book. The author is Roby Harris.
I was warned by several people not to do this book, that it would ruin my career. But I really didn't care. To me, it wasn't controversial. It's what every child has a right to know.
The book includes sections on puberty, pregnancy, and sexual orientation, all fact-checked by experts like pediatricians and biologists. Internet safety and sexting are new topics in this edition.
Here are some things you need to think about when you go on the Internet. There can be a lot of inappropriate, weird, confusing, uncomfortable, creepy, scary, or even dangerous websites that you can end up on when looking for information.
This edition also has new explanations of gender and sexual abuse. Past editions have included other cultural changes, for example, birth control laws, AIDS prevention, and info for gay youth. A lot of parents don't want their kids learning about that kind of sensitive information without supervision. Carrie Fritz of Culver City, California, has two kids in elementary school. I caught up with him as he was waiting to pick them up from school and asked him his impressions of the book. What do you think?
Well, I was shocked. I didn't read the cover.
He flips through the pages and stops at a full-color illustration of various birth control methods and how to use them.
See, if they saw this without me, I'd probably feel a little frustrated. Look at that. I mean, that would take time for me to have to explain.
What are you seeing there that's making you say that?
Well, right here, at least what it's doing here is just talking about sexual activity, which I don't think a 10-year-old needs to worry about.
Over the years, many parents who share this sentiment have asked for the book to be put in a restricted section of the library. It's not a ban. Parents just don't want their kids to come across it accidentally. Author Roby Harris doesn't think that's a good solution.
No child's going to go up to a librarian and say, you know, I'm going through puberty. I'm having these changes. I seem to have some pubic hairs, and maybe you could recommend something to me. So if a book is in a special section of a library, maybe the kids who need it the most are not going to get it.
The latest edition of It's Perfectly Normal hit shelves earlier this month. So far, it has not been challenged. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
10.5 years ago, a 22-year-old from Chicago stepped in front of a trio of judges to audition for the third season of American Idol.
All right, what you gonna sing?
Show Your Love With Me by Aretha Franklin. It's an evil wind that blows no good, yeah, yeah.
Jennifer Hudson would finish in just 7th place that season, but she'd go on to win an Academy Award for her role in the movie Dreamgirls and score a Grammy with her very first album. But she's also faced unthinkable tragedy. In 2008, her mother, brother, and nephew were murdered. The trial didn't wrap until 2012. It was months before she came back to the studio to start recording her third album. Hudson had won over audiences singing big, emotional ballads. But she told me this time she wanted to take a new direction. I do it by the thrill, even if it kills. Dangerous. You make me feel dangerous. Jennifer Hudson's new album is called J-Hud, and she dropped by our studios at NPR West to talk about her new sound.
It's expressive of my energy and, like, my everyday person. Mm-hmm. You'll definitely get that. Like, whereas the other music before, the space I was in was more about, like, singing. You know, singing right notes and it being just about that. But now this time, like, I have a new, like, take on what music represents for me, you know, and it's more about celebrating it and, nice. Yeah, and the energy of it, feeling the energy from the people, them feeling my energy, which is what I call Jenniferizing. Jenniferizing you with that energy in that album. He ain't moving.
The brightness, in a way, it's almost a little bit surprising because you've been through some rough times recently, and it's nice to hear the happiness.
Yeah, you know, and I just think overall I've been like tokened as a very heavy artist, a heavy actress, a heavy life and life experiences, and it's like, but that's not me, you know. It's I guess it's something I understand and it's a part of me, but the thing that's most of Jennifer is my positive energy that brings me out of all of it. So that's why this was so important to create in this way and for people to get that and understand it, you know.
You can be deep without being heavy.
Yeah, like even in the heaviest times I find the brightest light.
I feel like I'm in love. That is nice. That defines what's in the hearts.
So it sounds like, and I really feel like I hear this on the record, that you're being more yourself here. Yeah. There are more songs from you on this album.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. That's probably one of my favorite parts of this album. This album, I did not record anything I didn't love. Mm-hmm. And
Have you done that in the past?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah?
On album one and two, it was like, okay, well, they said sing this. It was before, it was Jennifer, just sing this. Okay. I can sing anything, sure. I'll sing it. But it's now, it's like, no, I didn't sing anything I didn't love. Mm-hmm. And I helped write a lot of stuff. I helped produce a lot of things, you know. If I didn't write it, I was able to construct it musically the way I wanted it to go, you know. And that's why through each song, it's like a piece of me.
Well, which is the first song that you sat down and wrote kind of in this with this new mindset?
Wow. I know Walk It Out, for sure. We ended up changing the verses to me, whatever, from my perspective, of whatever I decided to write for it, which made it that much more true to me. And in this song, it's like, this remind me of growing up. You know, this remind me of the South Side of Chicago. This remind me of when we used to sit on the porch and the boys would be playing basketball in the playground, or the girls walking to the store jumping rope and they're trying to talk to us. You know what I mean? Like, it just took me back to that space. So even when we got to the music video, I was like, we need to shoot this in Chicago. And it took me back to growing up, you know, and I wanted to just relive all of that. And that's what that song, I feel like, gave me. And that's where it ended up, in that space. I know you want to take me to your room. And I want to go your way, way, way. But you got to treat me like a lady. We should just.
Performance. I read that you learned about performing, singing in gay bars. Mm-hmm. There was a line you said, where is it? You said that was my training.
It was. I mean, because I didn't start singing with my eyes open until I was like 19, okay? Because I spent majority of my time singing in church or in school. And by the time I got to like high school, I would go with my assistant, who's my assistant now, Walter Williams, and we would go to the gay clubs. And it would always be like drag queens lip singing. They would be dressed for the gods. And I loved it. It would be like a talent show. And it was a prize. But the people would give you tips. So I'm sitting there like, wait a minute. They're lip singing? This is an interesting concept. Okay, they're not real girls, but they're drag queens and they're fierce. Wait a minute. I'm a real girl. And I got big hair too and eyelashes. Hold on. And I sing for real. So what if I came in here and started singing? What would happen? And so that's what I started to do. And they used to dress me and make my costumes. I had my own glam squad. And I would go perform. And then I started to, like, win all the money. And that was our thing. Yeah. And I used to make, like, that's when I really started to, like, get out and perform.
Okay, so here we go.
Ooh. Give me that.
So it's been almost exactly 10 years since you were on American Idol. What's it like to look back on that?
Oh, my God. You know, I am
the 2014.
It's so fresh in my mind. Like, this is a 10-year anniversary, and to think how far I've come, and it's amazing. Like, wow. In 10 years.
A lot of us are still sore feeling like you got robbed.
Oh, please. Please. You know, I can't complain, you know, like.
Yeah, you've done pretty well.
I've done extremely well, and that's the thing that blows my mind. Because, let me say this, when I auditioned for Idol, I didn't say I wanted to win. I said, I want to do this for the experience. I feel as though, like, if I say something, it, like, happens. And I said, no, I want to do this for the experience. And it still hunts me because I'm still experiencing it to this day. 10 years later, like, without Idol and all of that, then would I be sitting here right now? And look at how much I've been able to build and the things I've been able to experience. I would have never guessed I would have won an Oscar and a Grammy off of my first album and everything else. You know what I mean? And so I'm still experiencing it to this day.
Jennifer Hudson, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Bring back the music. Bring back the
Gail Sheehy changed how we think about getting older with her hugely influential 1976 bestseller, Passages. Instead of assuming character development largely ended with adulthood, she examined the crises that transform us throughout our lives. Sheehy also perfected a kind of in-depth character portrait that became her calling card. She's written about Hillary Clinton, Mikhail Gorbachev, Margaret Thatcher, and so many other influential people. Now she's turned her sights on a trailblazing woman who made a name for herself in journalism at a time when that profession was dominated by men. Gail Sheehy herself. I spoke with her about her new memoir, Daring, My Passages, earlier this week. I asked about her process when she writes these profiles she's so famous for.
I'm looking for their character, which is not about policy. Character is what was yesterday and will be tomorrow. What I do is, or did when people were affording it, was to interview no less than 40 people who knew the person that I was writing about. And they would provide incredible insights into a person's habitual behavior. So that by the time I got to my quarry, I could collaborate with them on trying to lay out the themes of their life, and they were much less resistant than they would be if I just walked in and started hammering them with difficult questions.
Of course, there is still resistance among people, and the first figure that comes to mind is Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
When you wrote your book about her back in the late 90s, you got pretty well attacked by the Clinton supporters.
I did afterwards, but not while I was working with her. And it really was because she made a revelation in the middle of one of our major interviews about George Bush Sr.'s Jennifer.
Referring to in the 1992 presidential campaign, President George H.W. Bush versus then Governor Clinton. Governor Clinton, there were revelations about an affair that he'd had, and Mrs. Clinton was complaining about there were also allegations that didn't really get printed as much about President George H.W. Bush having an affair himself.
Exactly. And that was the revelation that she kind of dumped on me in the middle of an interview. She wanted to get it out there, but she assumed that I would never attach it to her.
Over the course of your career, and obviously there's so much in this book that we won't be able to get to, but you shattered a glass ceiling or two in yourself in your career. And, you know, there are a lot more women journalists working now.
Yes.
I'm wondering, what was it about the time that you were breaking through that made it possible, or was the progress just inevitable?
Well, it didn't seem possible. When I crept down from the back stairs at the Herald Tribune from the women's department, which was the estrogen zone, and crossed into the testosterone preserve of the city room and marched my way over to Clay Felker's office to pitch him a story, I could have gotten fired from it. But he was intrigued and told me to write it as a scene. And I thought, write journalism as a scene using dialogue and my own experience of the scene? That was totally new in 1966. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with New York Magazine, which was breaking through into new territory for journalism, which became mainstream eventually.
Right. And you were, I know you don't like this phrase, but it's been said that you were one of the first women to be able to have it all, as they say. You had a career, you had a family, you had a husband, and
not until I was in my late 40s did I pull those three things together. And in fact, I don't buy the phony expectation that we can have it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I've come to understand is that I have enough. I have enough to give it away by using my talent to write and speak and hope that my experiences excite others to be daring. And the other thing is, daring might imply that I'm fearless.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the opposite is true. In my memoir, I admit that I've been as fearful of success as of failure. In fact, when Passages was published, I so dreaded bad reviews that I ran away to Italy with a girlfriend and our children to hide out. And it was only on our last day that Clay Felker called and said my book had jumped onto the bestseller list, which totally floored me. But what I learned from writing my memoir is that when I fear, I dare. Because I find fear paralyzing, and daring is action.
Hmm. Now, the book Passages, I think that covered passages in one's life up until the age of about 55. Is that
right?
That's right. And you're 70 now, right?
That's right.
So tell me about what you've learned that you left off in that book.
Well, it was so naive to think that there was nothing interesting that happened after 55. Come on. There's a whole second adulthood. What I found, I learned the most about life in my 60s. When my husband, Clay Felker, was slowly dying, I fell into depression, and my latent Irish gene for alcoholism flared up. And that led me to a 12-step program. And so that's when I came to understand having a spiritual foundation and realizing that you have enough.
We were talking earlier about your approach to these, you know, marvelous psychological profiles, portraits that you would do of important figures. Did you take that same approach in looking at yourself, looking at your own life?
I did, indeed. That's why I called it My Passages. I wasn't writing about the nice, long, calm periods. I was writing about the times when, yow, everything is exploding, for good or for bad. And I actually interviewed other people about myself, and that alerted me to the fact that I had to really investigate my memories.
It was just as tough as cracking those other characters.
It was tougher, I must say.
Journalist and author Gail Sheehy's new memoir is called Daring, My Passages. Gail, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Aaron.
We are 3 weeks into the NFL season now, but very little of the conversation around the NFL these days is focused on the game. Several players have been involved in incidents involving or alleging domestic violence. It's made many fans question the sport and the men who play it. Yesterday, for the first time in more than a week, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell spoke publicly about the incidents and the league's handling of them.
Unfortunately, over the past several weeks, we have seen all too much of the NFL doing wrong.
We wondered how far that wrong trickles down, how it affects football at all levels. NPR's Nathan Rott went to a Friday night football game in Gardena, California, just south of Los Angeles, to find out.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Sarah High School.
It's a packed house under the lights at Sarah High School. People pile into the stands, the marching band plays, and the team is pumped. The Sarah Cavaliers are something of a powerhouse in Southern California. They're the 22nd ranked team in the state. Many of their players are looking at Division I scholarship offers. And in recent years, they've graduated a number of guys that have gone on to play in the pros. Midway through the first quarter, they show they're still not hurting for talent. So yeah, football is a pretty big thing here, and fans like Jane Austen are upset when they see its stars, like ex-Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice, physically assault his now wife.
That's the mother of your child, and you should treat her with all the respect in the world.
Or when Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson was indicted on child abuse charges.
I mean, you know, I'm from the South. I got whippings too. But you have to know what the boundary is.
But Austin says that doesn't affect how people feel about the sport overall.
No, because if you're a football lover, you're going to be a football lover to the heart, no matter what.
Dyshawn Roberson sees it the same way. She's the mom of Sarah's star running back. And, yeah, she worries about football and injuries like concussions.
But it can bring more positivity to your son than anything else.
And she says it beats the alternatives, like drugs and alcohol, that she says pushes kids away.
Football brings your kids closer. Because when this is over with, my son's going to say, did you see what I...
So what of those teenage boys? I ask a group outside the stadium about the charges against players. They joke and jaw, like boys do. None of them condone what's happened, but they have some choice words about how people are reacting.
It's crap.
It's not necessary bullcrap.
Because you think they get a bad rap because they're athletes?
Yeah.
But Sarah coach Scott Altenberg doesn't see it that way. He says he's using what's happening in the NFL as a teaching moment, a time to talk to his athletes, many of whom will go on to play at higher levels, about accountability, what it means to be an athlete, and what it means to be a man.
It's unfortunate that these things have made it a forum that I can access now with my kids, but I'm absolutely going full bore on it. I think that's good for our kids. They need it.
Some good in weeks filled with bad. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Football is doing better and better. And by football, of course, I mean soccer. As the NFL seems to lurch from scandal to scandal, 2014 has been the highest-rated year ever for soccer broadcasts in the U.S. Two guys in particular couldn't be happier, Michael Davies and Roger Bennett, a.k.a. the Men in Blazers. Just months ago, you could only find their show, Men in Blazers, as a podcast on ESPN's website Grantland. But their irresistible, manic humor quickly caught on, and ESPN sent them to the 2014 World Cup. Well, to Brazil, at least. The sports network put them in a small TV booth, wound them up, and let them go.
Today, everybody we work with pretty much has gone off to the football.
Yeah.
But
not us.
Not us. I mean, why would you come all the way to Brazil?
Yeah. To watch football.
To go to the actual games, when you can sit in a closet and talk about football, which you haven't been to.
Yeah.
From there, Men in Blazers took off. Their podcast shot to the top of the iTunes charts. The New York Times profiled them. And starting this week, you'll be able to watch a full half hour of the Men in Blazers every Monday night on NBC Sports. I caught up with Raj and Dave-O and asked them to start by describing their show for people who haven't seen it.
Very good-looking men.
We're like Kathy Lee and Hodor.
Hodor. Yeah, that would be... Kathy Lee and Hodor would be a much more interesting show.
We're like True Detective, but a little bit darker.
Okay. No, we regard as... Like, the podcast is one thing. On TV, we regard that the television program we're about to make... We think we're about to make the least technologically advanced television program in the entire history of the medium.
We actually thought when they said, would you like to make a show about football on Monday night? We thought they were hiring us to do Monday night football. And we jumped at the chance.
Yeah.
Mentioned that you're very low tech. And one of the things about the show that's really kind of signature, aside from the banter that you guys have, is you have a very unique visual style in how you illustrate the things you're talking about.
Well, one camera.
And two bald men.
And lots of facial expressions. I mean, a formative experience in both of our lives as immigrants to the New World in the early 17th century was seeing the George Michael sports machine, what we regard as the greatest television program ever made in American sports television.
I grew up in D.C. I love the sports machine.
We came from a country that never had sports highlights. Occasionally, at the end of the news, they might give you the score of a game that happened earlier, but we never had highlights. And to have a whole show hosted by this amazing man, a god to us, George Michael, where he just had a machine that would take you around the world to see the greatest sports highlights and bloopers.
It was like a 1950s like UNIVAC style computer.
Well,
giant.
We have now, and so we have a 2014 style one of those, a little switcher that sits in front of me, and I'm going to play clips from our machine as a tribute to George Michael and his better machine.
And when we signed for NBC, we asked them to try and dig deep into their kind of basement and find any fragments of the George Michael sports machine which are left behind. And they shipped up this week the sign from the George Michael sports machine. And to have that hanging in our vicinity, he's definitely our inspiration.
You two have been together on your podcast for a few years now. How did the two of you meet, Raj?
We were both invited to a wedding of a mutual friend. And that wedding had the incredibly terrible taste to be scheduled for the World Cup final. And the 2006 World Cup final was the one that you may remember where Zidane, the great ball man, headbutted a crafty Italian and got sent off. The game went into extra time. And I was tying my tuxedo in front of the extra time. And my wife turned around to me and she said, "We've got to leave now. The wedding is on a boat. It leaves. It waits for no man." So I had to leave the World Cup final. I went to this wedding. I will be honest, my behaviour was rather that of a petulant teen. And there was another petulant teen at the back of the wedding who was also there.
That was me. So we met each other briefly there, but really we were brought together for the 2010 World Cup. We'd both been working for ESPN for a while, writing. And they brought us together and let us blog together, gave us a podcast together. And so we started that 4 years ago.
Raj, I want to do a hard-edge reporter thing here. I'm going to play some words that you said back to you. This is what you said back in June during the World Cup.
If the USA get out of this group G, G for go, go USA, G for glory, G for God bless America, I am going to become a citizen of the United States of America.
I hope it's a super ceremony. I'd love for George Michael himself to be exhumed and swear me in, as I imagine it. I'll be honest, I'm not the greatest at bureaucracy. I have just completed the application form to become an American citizen if this great country of ours will have me. I was fascinated by the number of questions you try and catch out those who are applying. Have you ever committed genocide? Have you ever run a brothel? Were you a member of the Nazi Party from 1933 to 1945? These are yes-no questions that I had to really think through. And I've now got past that stage. The papers are finished. I can tell you, there's not a single day I don't wake up and thank God that I live in this country. It's amazing. I think it's something that both Michael and I also share, as well as our love of football. We both love America.
That's Michael Davies and Roger Bennett. Their podcast, Men in Blazers, will on Monday premiere as the Men in Blazers show on NBC Sports. They'll be picking up the mantle from the great George Michael. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Arun, so much for having us on.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs, big and small. Georgia Durante was a model for Kodak Film, who went on to a lot of TV and commercial work as a stunt driver. In the 90s, she appeared in Chevrolet ads and was the stunt double for Cindy Crawford in a Pepsi commercial. What her Hollywood colleagues didn't know was that her driving skills were honed from a career as a getaway driver. Durante's story begins in New York City at a mafia-run club called Sundowners.
It didn't start until 2 o'clock in the morning, and people would leave at 6. When I first got there, you had to knock on the door like 3 times, and then a guy would open it, and if you were okay, let you in, you know. You never really knew what was going on. You were never told what was going on, but the intrigue was what really drew me into that world. It was a pretty dark world that I eventually, it wasn't fun anymore. It was scary. I'm there, and like 5 feet away from me, this guy pulls out a gun and shoots the guy next to him. Everybody scattered. The guy fell to the floor. Frankie was the owner of Sundowners, and Frankie threw me the car keys, and he says, "Georgia girl, go get the car, bring it up." Threw him in the back seat, and I'm in the driver's seat, so I'm driving to Bellevue Hospital. I'm only 17 at this time, you know? We get to the hospital, and we got there in record time, and they just pulled him out, left him on the sidewalk, beeped the horn, and took off. All they talked about was, "Man, Georgie girl, can you drive a car?" So it started out just picking up packages and delivering them to wherever, and they graduated to what they called pickups. And I would wait around the corner for these guys. I'd drop them off, wait around the corner, and they were actually robbing places, but they never told me. One day they came out with their guns out, and I heard sirens. And they jumped in the car and said, "Step on it." I was driving on sidewalks, down alleys. I ducked into one alley, and then we saw the cops go by, so they never saw us getting into the alley. And then once we didn't hear the sirens anymore, we knew it was safe to come out. It was intense. It was very intense. You know, I just got in pretty deep. This mob war breaks out, and they were killing everybody who knew anything. And I fled to California with my 7-year-old daughter. I end up in San Diego. And I was married to a guy in the mob at this time, and he was very abusive. And his abuse really became intense then. And my daughter and I, we would spend many nights out at the beach shivering, afraid to go home. If I could get out with my purse, you know, we'd go to the theater and watch the same movie over and over and over again, you know. And then one day, I took her by the hand, got in the car and started driving. And I just kept going. We ended up living in the car, and I'd steal food in convenience stores until I finally found my friend who lived in Brentwood, and he let us stay at his place. I was hiding from my husband. I was hiding from the mob. I couldn't be out there. And I said, "What, you know, what could I do? The only thing I've ever done is model, drive cars. That was it." So while I'm there, I'm watching TV every day, you know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do. But then I realized that every time there was a commercial, it was a car commercial.
"This is today's Chevrolet."
Most of the time, you could never see the driver. I said, "That's perfect." My friend, who was an actor, he knew when they were shooting commercials and where they were shooting them, and he would tell me where they were, and I'd show up on the location, and I'd start bugging these directors, and they'd look at me like, Yeah, sure, she can drive. Uh-huh. And finally said, all right, we'll see what you can do. And that was my big break. Before I knew it, I was turning down work. I was only one person. I couldn't do it all, you know? If I would have taken no for an answer, who knows where I'd be now.
That's Georgia Durante, stuntwoman and author of The Company She Keeps. You don't have to be a Hollywood stunt driver to have a big break. Tell us your story. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. For the week ending September 21st, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Chloe Prasinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.